Hey guys, this week's episode of A Glass for Every Palate comes with a special gift. Right now, for my listeners, we are offering a 50% off discount on your annual subscription to Somm TV. So go to SommTV.com right now, sign up for an annual membership, use code, wait for it, Shakera, S-H-A-K-E-R-A, for 50% off your annual subscription. That way you won't miss any episodes of any of the amazing shows, including mine, on the Somm TV streaming platform. Welcome to this week's episode of A Glass for Every Palate. I mean, I feel like you can't see me, but I feel like I should be dressed in royal colors because today we are truly talking to wine royalty. Today's guest is a legend, a fellow Caribbean with a little bit of Latina spice in there, a mom, a consummate wine professional, a spark of joy everywhere. Today's guest is Nadine Brown. Hi, Nadine.
How are you? I need to wake up to that every day. Thank you so much for that amazing introduction.
Listen, we'll record that and send it to you.
I'm gonna write it on post-it notes.
And stick it to your mirror. You deserve it. So this season, we've taken a different approach where for every guest that I have, I kind of think about a theme that's going to guide us through the conversation. And for you, there were so many that I could think of. But the one that I chose to go with is steadfast. Because I think that through all of the changes in geographically where you've been, professionally where you've been, personally where you've been, you've remained this steadfast professional committed to sharing amazing wines with people, showing up as you are, and centering hospitality at the core of what you do. And it's so inspiring. So that's going to be the lens that we talk through today.
Awesome.
So let's start with how a Jamaican girl.
Right.
Ends up, like, talk us through how wine became a part of your identity, really.
You know, I think I would start with saying that Jamaicans are everywhere, right?
Absolutely.
And in everything, you know, from our vice president being part Jamaican, I mean, we, you know, go all over the world and are hard workers. I'm from Jamaica. I was there till I was 12 and moved to San Juan, Puerto Rico, went to high school there. And then went off to school in Boston. I loved Puerto Rico. Best food, best music, best people. And always wanted to work with kids. I read some book when I was young and decided I wanted to be a child psychologist or do art therapy. I also paint. So I wanted to work with kids for as long as I remembered. So I went off to college to get a degree in social work and did that for a couple of years. And that doesn't really explain how I got into wine.
I'm still following the trail. Like, oh, now we doing social work. Okay. All right.
But, you know, the restaurant industry and wine industry are full of people that did something else, or restaurants on the floor, they're full of literally accountants,
yeah,
people that thought they wanted to be lawyers, the whole gamut. I think I broke up with some boy or something in Boston and moved to DC in 1996. So when I moved to Boston from Puerto Rico, my family moved to DC. My mom worked for the Jamaican Embassy opening offices. We didn't move around a lot, you know, not really like Navy brat kids, but that's why we moved to Puerto Rico and then to DC. And I tried to find a job in my field. I think I worked at a photo shop for a little bit. Then there was an ad in the Washington Post, a new French restaurant opening on Capitol Hill. They were looking for a host, no experience needed. And I called and this garbly British guy answered the phone, who's still a friend and mentor. And that was 20 years ago. Right. Had every intention of going back to social work, but I got bitten by that restaurant bug, you know,
that
first.
Got you.
Even before wine. Yeah. The chaos. I know you go out a lot, right?
I do.
Yeah.
It's beautiful chaos, though. Yeah. I also love jazz music because I feel like it's organized chaos and it's beautiful to watch.
Yes.
I just have to point out, though, that whole path that you just took to wine, that was the most Jamaican description ever. If you guys know any Jamaicans, they're notorious for having 15 different jobs. Caribbean people in general, they never have one job. So that was the most culturally relevant and relatable thing ever. Okay, so now here you are, you're a hostess at this restaurant, and it's not the restaurant energy that gets you. It's hospitality. You know, you can kind of see a parallel in there between being a social worker and this concept of being in service.
Right.
That's a funny thing that we're dealing with now and how people approach hospitality. We're like, yes, yeah. It's a service industry, but people are not in servitude or subjugation to you.
Yeah.
So a French restaurant on Capitol Hill attracts a very interesting group of people.
Right.
Tell us about that being your first foray into hospitality in general.
Yeah. You know, the energy of restaurants. We're literally right on the steps of the Capitol. So I was seating Ted Kennedy and meeting, you know, heads of states and that kind of thing. And I think that hospitality, I never really thought about it, just that Jamaican part of hospitality. You hear about it all the time when people visit the island, and even people that are not in hospitality, there's just a, I don't want to say a natural, just a, you know, a friendly kind of can talk to anyone kind of ethos.
Yeah.
That's with a lot of people, but the island's then known for. My mom could talk to anybody. Right? Like from heads of state to the person on the corner, you know, selling stuff. So I'm really good at, you know, just speaking to everyone and being comfortable, you know, talking to everyone, no matter their status or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did fall in love with the buzz of the floor.
And how did you move from being hostess into, was it just an opportunity became available? Was there a glass or a bottle that you happened to taste one night after service?
Taste right.
Yeah, man. How did that transition go?
Yeah, so even that was more gradual. I think today, like people, you know, might know at 18, I want to be an Astra Sommelier and lay out that track. But I was a host, and I think at first the managers were really busy. I was like, hey, I can write the host schedule for you. And then I started typing up the menus for the daily specials. So that got me downstairs in the office. And I still have my book back here, like the Food Lover's Companion, you know, looking up all the definitions. You know, what is Mirepoix? All of these things that I was typing and just really interested with the history. History was an early hook for me.
Okay.
So yeah, and then I asked to be a manager. I actually moved up pretty quickly from being a host to a manager, but wine was my weak spot in terms of leading people and being a manager. So I took my first wine captain course. Bistro Beast was the name of the restaurant. And there are also a lot of collectors. I have a lot of gratitude for collectors. There's a lot of great collectors in the city and that have been really generous. So I got a lot to taste a lot of amazing things really early. You know, I joke that I went from Boone's Farm to Montrachet and kind of jumped, skipped over. You know,
that is
a lot of stuff there.
That is a jump.
Yeah. So drinking this stuff and just kind of backtracking and learning about what I was drinking.
You know, I think it's interesting how many people I meet that are very much into wine that almost always have some love of history as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's because those two things are so intertwined. And when you really dive into the history, I mean, you know how I feel about Spain.
Yes.
Wine in Spain was so much more about conflict and commerce than anything else. Like, never mind all the stuff we do now. It was really a currency and it was the means to so much. And I think you either get the opportunity to go from Boone's Farm to Montrachet, which signed me up for that track, but also it's a story in a bottle that you can fall in love with. All right, so you take your first wine captain class and what do you think about it? Do you like it? Are you interested?
Oh, I loved it. You know, I think it was 11 weeks and really intense and there was a lot of tasting and really just diving down. It was more regions and then also similar to WSET, you know, where you'd have spirits, fortified wines. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. And it started me down these what I call rabbit holes. You know, I have books in here on vanilla and tea and, you know, that spun off of interest in wines, you know. So then I'm reading a whole book about the vanilla bean, which is an orchid and, you know, da 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 da. Like, I'm just a naturally curious person. You know, I'm curious about a lot of different things. I know a little about a lot, you know, thanks to NPR and other things in terms of, you know, back to talking to people, right? It's not a multi-billion dollar industry just because people are hungry.
Yeah.
People go out to dine for a lot of reason. And wine is such a great way to help people make experiences and connect.
It really is. And I think about sometimes you're just being you and you're not even aware of like how rare or unusual you are because you're just you. So Capitol Hill, senators, lobbyists, lawyers, characters,
right.
Everybody there. Did it always feel like you were received well and welcomed and like your personality led you? Or were there moments where it's kind of like, okay, go get the person that knows about wine, not you?
Yeah. You know, I've been really, I don't know the right word, fortunate. It's not fortunate, but fortunate. You know, I've had mostly great experiences. Even when I was a manager before I really got into wine, when people would say, let me see the manager, and I'd come over to the table. You know, I definitely got a couple like, okay, kind of looking around me, where's the manager? But I actually got more like, I still got the one up and down, but kind of like, oh, you girl, you know, kind of good for you. Kind of, you know, kind of thing, then negative. There were a couple of times at Charlie Palmer, you know, because both my assistant somms were white men, where I would come over to the table, you know, a gentleman would be like, well, I'm going to wait for that guy. Sometimes it would be, you know, like he had touched the table first, or if he was in a suit or had his pin on or whatever it is. But you just, you know, kind of brush it off and you keep going. I think you have to do that in hospitality anyway.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, because some table might say something to you. That's why you go out afterwards and have a drink and talk about everybody. But while you're in the shift, you just brush it off and keep going. And I think at once I was like, well, I choose my name at the top. You know, if you look at the front of the wine list, that's me at the top of the
my
list.
Name. A little respect on your name. It's crazy. You know, I think that hospitality is a unique, like, I think it is a science, right? I think it's a unique science because the concept of service, like you touched on it a little earlier, that I think culturally, like in Caribbean culture, it's almost an offense to not be hospitable, right? Like right now, right. If I show up right. at my mom's house with friends, she's going to start cooking. She had no intentions of cooking anything,
right.
But oh my God, there's a guest. What can I get you? I'm going to do something. I'm like, or we could just sit here and talk. And it's like, yes. No, why didn't you offer your friend anything? So I totally get what you're saying. And when that's innate. I always wonder for the time that you came kind of up in this industry and the places that you worked. It's always interesting to talk to women and women of color, not just women of color, women in particular, where like sometimes when you're just good at what you do, you don't even realize like you're the only woman.
Right.
Like you should. And maybe you do, like it does right. click, but you're so good at it that it doesn't impact you in the same way. But now that we're in the space that we are in the world, I wonder, like, have you had anyone say, well, you've been in a position to be a manager, why didn't you hire any other women? I've heard that in tech, and I'm always like, well, if I had more women apply and you created an earlier pipeline for it, then there'd be more women here, right? But if you gatekeep, and they don't even pursue this path, then I have an application pile full of men, and that's what I'm stuck to choose from, right?
Yeah.
So how do you feel like, has any of your perspective changed now in like how you cultivate the next generation of professionals and juxtaposition that with like, well, I did this too, and I kind of just read and was personable and made connections and networked and worked. Like, what is your philosophy and your managerial style now in bringing in and ushering in the next generation of hospitality professionals?
That was such a good question. And a layered question, you know. It wasn't luck. You know, I think success is hard work and, you know, putting your nose down. But there's also just being in the right place at the right time and element of luck, you know, in terms of being in Boston and these really small places that I've been. So I've been really fortunate that way. And even, you know, access to these amazing wines earlier on through investors that just happened to be coming into this restaurant that I happened to be working at. I had this great experience when we throw around this word that representation matters. And I understood what that meant. But I was at a portfolio tasting and someone came up and tapped me on the shoulder and I turned around. And it was a young, you know, African-American female, you know, rising Somali. And she's like, oh my God, AD, I'm so excited to meet you. You don't know me. I saw you, you know, on the Washingtonian 2003 and kind of you were the first Black white professional I saw or Black first female, or I didn't even think about this as a possibility.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of times there is that people are not applying, but I think people are just not aware. Either there's no exposure. So, you know, you have to kind of do things on purpose.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on the board of the Rhaetian Project and a big part of what we're doing, even just little things, it's expensive. I mean, the testing is expensive.
Yes.
Access to wine for blind tasting is expensive. So even something little as working with distributors to get people cases of wine to blind taste back to that access. I don't know if I'm really answering your question, but yes, my perspective definitely has changed. And I think it's in some ways maybe a little bit more difficult to do things organically like I did. I'm doing organically in quotations, you know, because I think people definitely want more certifications than they did. You mean even just applying for jobs, like they want you to have some letters behind your name even to get in the door.
But you know what's weird about that? It does make sense, but it's always funny to me. Like you touched on something earlier about like sometimes it's just right place, right time and luck, right? Like this podcast is largely in part because my hair caught on fire in a room with the right people, right? So sometimes it is just the randomness of the universe.
Yeah.
But also I think that this is something that I think that I struggle with when thinking about wine sometimes too, in that on one hand, wine is simply something to be enjoyed with food. It builds a community. It's tasty. I mean, you get a nice little buzz off of it. Some of the best times in your life can be had sharing bottles of wine with amazing people. At the same time, there are luxury hobbies. There are people that collect luxury cars. There are women that are into luxury, women and men that are into luxury fashion. Like there is a point where it's just everyone can drink wine and enjoy it as they please. And then it can also become a hobby that costs a lot of money or a profession that costs a lot of money. Becoming a lawyer costs a lot of money.
Right.
Becoming a doctor costs a lot of money. And there are good people that want to pursue these professions. Becoming a social worker, getting an MSW is a lot of money. Going into a career that you know is not financially lucrative. So that's always, and I'd love for us to chat about that a little bit, about like, how do we, as somebody that can share wine, like I love your videos where you're dancing a little salsa or you've got Aki pairing with things. Like, I love that you showcase like, yes, I can drink incredible Burgundy and these like insanely good wines. But when I'm in my house trying to get my kids to go to bed or I'm up before everyone else is and enjoying it, I can enjoy like everyday drinking wines too. Have you found it challenging to kind of balance both those things? Like there are allocated wines that there simply just isn't a lot of it. So there's going to be a level of luxury or it can be cost prohibited, but that doesn't mean that wine isn't for everyone. Like how have you kind of juggled that or balanced that out?
Yeah, I'm still pretty new to Instagram, which I really refound last year during COVID, you know, because they say you should figure out who your audience is. It was kind of difficult. You know, then I finally, you know, really decided to double down on hospitality. And I wrote that I'm here to serve novice to collectors, which is something that you do on the floor anyway, because I could be talking to one table that's literally going from iced tea to Riesling, you know, and talking to a lawyer collector that has had more experience and, you know, in some ways knows more about wine, you know, so it's not code switching. I mean, code switching is such a big word. Right. But I think it can have a lot of different reasons in terms of switching up, you know, your take, the way you speak about wine, you know, from table to table. So that's definitely something that I'm good at and something that I really learned working the floor in terms of, you know, being able to find wines for everyone. And just my understanding that it's a huge spectrum, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you and I have, you know, just spoken or, you know, briefly about, you know, feeling some sort of way about posting, you know, like a $400 bottle of Burgundy.
Yes.
You know? And I was like, well, it was like, you know, like right after I posted, you know, the Villefirme, like this great $8 rosé, which I love and I'm constantly talking about. And the next day I'm, you know.
And that's the thing. I think you can do both.
Yeah.
You can do all. Like, both. I mean, I'm not sitting in my house. Like I constantly say like, trust me, I'm not sitting in my house just cracking open $400 bottles of wine.
No.
And I think that even if cost wasn't an issue, I still like $15 Verdeo. Like, that's what I like drinking.
Yes.
I like Chenin that costs $15-$20. Like, those are still the wines that I very much enjoy drinking.
Right.
But I don't think no more then I need to be public about disdain for certain wines or whatever, because no one asked me, honestly. But if you ask me what I drink, I'll tell you it's not that. I don't think that we should shame, and I hate the word shaming because I think it's so overused and misplaced.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone should care, right?
Absolutely.
Like, if you see a bottle and the way the person talked about it was exciting and it's something you want to try, you go look it up. If you look it up and go, damn, that sounds good, but I am not buying a bottle of wine for $75. $1,000. I'm not there yet. Cool. No problem.
Yeah.
Stick around. Yeah. I guarantee you in a day or so, I'm going to post something that's $25 and you're going to be able to get that. Whereas like code switching, shaming, inclusivity, like they're all important, but they're so nuanced that there's not one way, you know, to talk right. about it or to enjoy it. And I think it's important to create space where everyone is free to enjoy it. Like it won't look the same. Like we could both be women and enjoy something differently. We could both be Black and enjoy something differently. We can both be Latinx and enjoy, you know what I mean? So yeah. I love seeing like the things that you do and the things you put out there. And I follow you because I know like one day she's going to have something pulling out her cellar. I'm like, where do you even find that now? I just want a little sip of what's left in the glass, just a taste and experience of that. And then the next day you're salsaing. And I love seeing that. And then on the point that you brought up about people wanting certifications and all that stuff, I think there's always value in education for me.
Yeah.
I think that I'm a dork and I like studying, but I think that education can come about in different ways. What is interesting to me though, is how many times I've spoken to and no, somebody listens, don't email me saying that I'm attacking white men because I'm not. And if I was, really, what power do I have over you? But anyway, I'm not. But many times I've had conversations with white men, right? And their story is somebody just took a chance on me. Somebody saw a passion in me and they just took a chance on me. But that's not always the case for most other people, right? Most other people need these credentials just to get their foot in the door. Like no one's taking a chance on you without that. So I bring this full circle to say, like now, we're coming back into being in the dining rooms and having guests in. Hospitality and the people and how people are treated has changed. If you're hiring someone now that over the course of this pandemic, they've gotten bitten by the wine bug and they don't really have as much experience, but you can see passion in them. Like, what are you looking for now if you're hiring someone to work on the floor?
That is a good question.
Oh, I try.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. What am I looking for now? On a kind of side note, I recommend everybody working in restaurants at some point, whether it's 6 months or a summer, you know, there's a lot of soft skills. So I think first I'd look for, you know, people with those soft skills, you know, because sales, you can sell, a lot of wines sell themselves, you know, and there are a lot of people with a lot of certifications who don't know how to talk to people or, you know, make people feel uncomfortable talking about wine. So I think first thing I would look for is some of those soft skills, you know, a lot of stuff you learn from your mom.
Yeah,
right? Work ethic is really important because, you know, especially on the floor, like it's a little different than 9 to 5. Restaurant culture is changing, which is great and long overdue. So yeah, I think I'd start by looking for someone with those soft skills and you can smell it out pretty early on. Someone with an open mind. I think the wine world is opening up, you know, in terms of different styles of wine, wines from different regions, you know, someone that's open to what's coming and what's next to come as well.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that that's a lot of the questions that I have for people now. Like, I feel like if you survived, and I think this is across the board, like not just in hospitality wine, I think that if you survived working during this pandemic, you have a whole new set of skill sets that you can now sell about yourself. I really think it's important too, in touching on women in general, you know, in almost every career that I think of, the decision to have children and to start a family can be extremely detrimental to our careers in a way that it has little to no impact on the effect of a man with the exact same job. So being a woman of color in this position, you decided to have your beautiful babies. Was that a plan? And how did you look at leaving the floor and potentially coming back after you had your children?
Yeah. Oof. Oof. Another great heavy question. You know, it was a plan. I was definitely a later mom, you know, I think because of working in restaurants and just kind of putting it off and putting it off. And I was never, you know, really one of those people, I must have kids, but I knew it was Oprah or something. It was just like, think about what you would regret on your deathbed. And I knew enough to know that I would regret it. If I was 80 and didn't have kids, I would regret it. And I never really left the floor. You know, that's also part of why I was at Charlie Palmer for 14 years, and they were just really awesome and supportive in terms of me being a mom, and mm-hmm. you know, Charlie's a great guy, and all of that stuff. I remember when I got pregnant with my son, I Googled, I was actually at work, I Googled pregnant sommelier, which is a random thing. I'd never, first, you know, not a lot of women, and definitely there was no visual of what this, I'm like, what am I going to have a belly working the floor? And I did, you know, I was big belly. I worked all the way, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks,
my God.
You know, before. And again, just mostly just incredible reception and feedback and positivity from guests and everyone. My taste buds changed, you know, so in terms of tasting wine, that was difficult. You know, I think I spat early on. When they were young, it was actually somewhat beneficial. You know, like when they're babies and they're sleeping all night anyway,
yeah.
you know, I'd go into work at 3. So I would do mommy and me and stuff with them earlier, you know, in the mornings, like with all the stay-at-home moms. And then, you know, like 2 o'clock, they're like, let's go have lunch. I'm like, I have to go to work. They're like, you work. You work? We had no idea you work, you know, because I was working 4 to 11 or whatever.
But that's steadfast.
Yeah.
That's why the theme of today was steadfast.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think that it's so important in hospitality and wine and just as a part of womanhood. You know, you have the choice to be a mom whenever. And I actually always love talking to mothers in general, but yeah. particularly women that have had their children later in life, because so much of society and particularly industries like this make it seem like your life or your career is over.
Right.
Should you decide to make the decision to become a mother, and it's not. And it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, like people love the word balance, and this is going to be such a good segue into wine. People love the word balance and seeking balance in life and work-life balance. And I actually fundamentally don't think that's possible because balance means that all things are equal, right?
Yeah.
That you are equally in any given moment, all of these things, and it's impossible to be that. Like sometimes you don't have a good day at work. Some days you might not be the best mom, your kids, your husband, everybody's getting on your nerves. Some days you're not the best friend. And that's okay. Like life is about prioritizing and, you know, centering. And I love that approach differently. And I think that everything about the way your career has evolved and all the things we talk about, like you've never once mentioned balance. You've just mentioned like, I figured it out. I did it.
Yeah.
I didn't know about wine. So I started reading and then I fell down a rabbit hole and started reading about vanilla and stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's life. And I love being able to talk about that part of your journey and your story. And so since we're talking about balance.
Oh yeah, there's no balance doing, you know, inventory while getting sonograms. I mean, I also made stuff up, you know, taking the kids in, literally my 2-year-olds pulling bottles out of boxes, doing inventory. But yeah, you make it happen.
You make it happen. Well, let's talk a little bit about balance and wine, right? Because I think that it's no different than teachers in school, that there were some teachers that you just gravitated to, the way they talk, the choice of language that they used, the way they framed the material. You just liked learning from them. You are one of those people for me where I just love and appreciate the language you use, the references. It just always resonates with me. And I think that you have such a range of people that you get to share wine with. When you are talking to newer people in wine that want to get into it, so there's going to be 2 questions. So when you're talking to newer people, what is it that you center for them as they taste and explore? And funny enough, I actually think it would be harder to get people that have been drinking excited in something new, excited in something that is outside. Like if you only drink Napa Cabs, how do you get them to drink Priorat, right? So talk a little bit about the approach of a new person getting into wine. What advice or tips or how would you center that journey? And then for people that are longtime seasoned drinkers, how do you get them excited about something new?
You know, that's a good question. So I've been teasing, you know, in terms of the, you know, the Napa drinker or the I only drink 82 Bordeaux person. You're right. It is hard. Or people that are over-certified. Not that there's anything wrong with certification. I just do over-certified in quotations. And hopefully it's changing. I feel like they focus on faults a lot, identifying of what a fault is in a wine and the classical structures of wine, which I get. And I think there's importance to that, you know, because stuff has tasted the same. Sancerre has tasted the same for 100 years, and they want it to taste the same, you know, for the next 100 years. So that's different. Yeah, so helping people find their hook. Mm. You know, I think for some people are using music right now really creatively, and that is the hook to get people into wine. People that don't drink wine specifically,
yeah,
you know, using music, using history, you know, kind of meeting them where they are, what their interest is in order to help, you know, bring them into wine. I don't think people are aware of all the rabbit holes,
yeah,
you know, in wine. And for the other drinkers, it's finding the best example, you know, of that category.
Yeah.
You know, like, remember, I poured a lot of American wine at Charlie Palmer. And you're like, so if I had a wine from Texas, I made sure it was the best wine from Texas.
Yeah.
You know, because it wouldn't do Texas or myself any good to have a subpar Texas, almost something that over-delivered, you know. So a lot, yeah, of my wines from other states, people would always be like, wow, this is from Texas, or, you know, this is a Massachusetts sparkling. You just kind of blow people away. And, you know, a lot of this stuff sounds like cliches, you know, talk about the stories and talk about the people.
Yeah.
I think that's something which is still kind of finding their hook. Hey, this is a single mom took on a state of Delaware in order to change their wine laws so they can make wine.
Yeah.
Then you pour it in the glass and then they taste it. You know, and this is an 82 Bordeaux collector person, right? And I think they'll leave, you know, a little bit more open the next time to, hey, I'm, you know, at Daniel Blue's place and he has a Finger Lakes Riesling.
Yeah.
I'm going to give this a try.
And I love that. I mean, I think that that's, especially for newer drinkers that are going out to dinner and intimidated by a list. I'm like, if you're at a good restaurant, everything on the list is likely good, right? Like, stay in the budget, talk about what you like,
right,
and get it. You
I
know
like
what I mean?
That.
If it's a Finger Lake Riesling, it's so important. And I think that people see that. I'm like, there's actually nothing wrong with you going, look, this meal is expensive. I just want a good wine to go with it.
Yeah.
I do not want to spend more than $100 on wine. Okay. If they can't find you a bottle, don't drink. Like, literally get cocktails then if they, you know what I mean? But I think
right.
That's so important to demystify a lot of this stuff. Oh my goodness, I could talk to you forever and a day, but you've given me so much time. We have to do this quick lightning round, though I do this with everyone, so you can't give much thought to these questions.
Okay.
All right, ready?
Excellent.
Okay.
Okay.
The day is going really, really well. Everything that could possibly go right is going better than right. You are done with the day, kids are to bed, house is clean, dinner's cooked, you're just chilling. What do you drink?
Bourbon.
Mmm. All
That's
right.
Not helpful. Bourbon.
No.
A bourbon cocktail.
Is. Okay. I love bourbon cocktails, so that works for me. All right. Total opposite happened. Kid has spilt bag of flour all over the floor. POS is down. Everything that could possibly go wrong in one day is going wrong. What do you drink then?
You know, I think I'm going in the cellar and getting one of those open that bottle night wines, you know, something
yeah.
I've been sitting on and open something, treat myself to something nice.
I love it. A treat yeah. yourself moment. Okay, this question is about unpopular opinions. What is the grape region or wine that people absolutely love and you do not at all? Like, you are meh towards
this. I don't think there is one. There has to
well,
be
that's
one,
good.
Right?
Okay, I'll be more specific. One grape has to go. Never again to be made into wine on the planet.
One grape has to go. Torontos?
Yeah, that can go. I'm agreeing
yeah.
with you. That one can go.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
last but not least, best advice you would give to somebody that is just starting to explore wine because they're so hung up on kind of what should I drink? Who should I buy? How much should it cost? What's the one piece of advice you would give to them to make sure that they enjoy this journey that they're on?
Yeah. I mean, I think you just said it, that it's a marathon, not a sprint, and that it's, you know, it's a journey. I think learning wine is a lifelong endeavor. Wine is always changing. There's probably a new DOCG as we've been talking here, you know, so just think about it as a long word of learning and tasting and retasting and relearning.
I could not agree more. I could not agree more. Wow. I am so, so grateful for your time and for this conversation.
Thank you.
Before we wrap up, I want to make sure that people know exactly where they can follow you. So please share.
Yeah. So it's Instagram and it's Nadine Wine Brown.
There we go.
And Nadine Wine Brown on Twitter, but Nadine Wine Brown.
And Nadine Wine Brown plays some really, really classic, if you like, Salsa Bachata music. She drops some gems in there, that will have you dancing with your broom if you're like me.
Awesome.
I want to thank you again. You have been so inspirational to me as I've been on this journey. It is amazing and an honor to have had you to have this very robust conversation on an amazing career. So keep inspiring.
Thank you.
Guys, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. And until next week, bye. Oh my goodness, guys, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. We are offering a special gift to all of my amazing listeners. If you haven't subscribed yet, head on over to SomTV.com. Right now, if you enter the code Shakera, S-H-A-K-E-R-A, you will get 50% off your annual membership. And so that makes sure you don't miss any of the amazing content, including a couple things that feature me, on SomTV. Head on over to SomTV.com, use code Shakera, and sign up for your yearly subscription now.